Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey everyone, I'm Ian DeBorja, and welcome to IMDb's Movies That Changed My Life, a podcast where your favorite stars break down the films that made them who they are today. This week's guest is actor, comedian, and musician Reggie Watts. You may know Reggie from his role in comedy Bang Bang or as the band leader for The Late Late Show with James Corden. But he joins me today to talk about his role as Chancellor in the SpongeBob movie Sponge on the Run. Reggie and I talk about the constructs of reality, that time I saw him at a music festival in 2012, and the movies that changed his life. If you're enjoying the show and haven't given us a review yet, please do, and I'll read it out on next week's episode. Thanks to Gerald Borgs and T. Moses for the most recent 5-star reviews. If you want to join in the conversation on social media, use the hashtag #MoviesThatChangedMyLife, and we'll read them out here as well. Thanks so much for listening. Here's Movies That Changed My Life with Reggie Watts. Reggie, I love when we get our firsts on the show. Typically, that means it's the first time we talk about a specific film or a specific director. But in your case, you're the first guest I've actually seen live in person at a music festival. I saw you on stage way back in 2012, and now I'm glad we get to talk full circle. What is it, 8-9 years later?
Yeah, damn.
To discuss some of your favorite movies.
I love it. Love it.
We're going to talk about the movies that changed your life a little later in the episode. Before we get to that, let's chat a little bit about the SpongeBob movie, Sponge on the Run. And I know you play the character of Chancellor, but for those who don't know, what's the plot of this movie? And then who do you play?
Gary goes missing, and everybody freaks out. And the reason why he goes missing is because Poseidon, I believe it's Poseidon, not Neptune. Well, he has a skincare regimen, and he needs his snails to make his skin look really good. So he rubs snails all over. And then once they're discarded, he just like gets rid of them through a vacuum tube chute. And he's run out of snails, so he needs a snail. And so, of course, the snail character, Gary, gets trapped and caught by them to be used as part of his skincare regimen. And so, of course, SpongeBob and the crew decide that they have to go on a rescue mission. And so they head to Atlantic City. Oh, sorry, Atlantis City.
Atlantis
City. I wasn't sure. I was like, is it Atlantis or did they just stick with Atlantic? No, Atlantis City. Yeah, so they go there, which is a giant, like, you know, what you would think, a gambling hub, whatever, show Ganza. And Poseidon is chilling there, you know, doing a skincare regimen. And they just need to get their friend back. And there's a whole wacky adventure road trip thing that happens. It's crazy. And I'm going to see it tonight for the first time.
Oh, nice. And so who do you play? You're the Chancellor, right?
Yeah.
And what do you get to do?
Well, he's a take on Chandler from Friends. And I do, no, just kidding. He's, yeah, so he's basically, he's the right-hand man to Poseidon. So he, you know, he's the guy who kind of does all the busy work, you know, and make sure that he presents decrees and things to Poseidon to sign and make sure that stuff that Poseidon wants is done, and he's trying to stay, you know, 3 steps ahead, that kind of a cat. But of course, he's got a little bit of his own agenda, as those people tend to do. And so he slips in his own things that he needs once in a while. He's a really fun character. He's kind of like a jazz, a hep jazz guy.
It's so funny. SpongeBob came out, I mean, 20 plus years ago, but it still has his hold, like, not only as a TV show in this movie, but it has this infinite hold on the internet. Like, people love the memes. I think people are trying to get it into the Super Bowl halftime show last year and all that sort of stuff. Do you have any theories? I know you are a master of the internet yourself. Do you have any theories as to why SpongeBob retains its relevance over these years?
It's like any good piece of art. You know, there's just, it's a timeless world concept show. And it obviously, you know, it was in the 90s. I remember seeing, that's the problem. It's like, I don't remember a lot of the characters' names because I didn't watch it when it was out. I knew my friends were huge fans of it. I mean, like, I was surrounded by fans of it, but I didn't have a TV at the time in the 90s. I didn't do anything in the 90s. Uh-huh. Really. I just kind of existed. I forgot to take photographs, which, you know, I'm regretting now to this day. But yeah, so I knew of it. I saw the lunch boxes. I saw the paraphernalia. I saw people, you know, doing inside jokes and doing their versions of the characters' voices and all that stuff. But I didn't really know a lot about it. But the things that when I got this role, I got offered the role. I sat down with my friend Andrea, and who's like a huge, huge, huge fan of the show. And we just sat down and I watched the very first episode and just kind of skipped through the seasons, you know, up until, you know, from 4-3. Ratio to 16:9, and I saw, like, in the beginning, it started as something that was kind of underground, a little bit, a kind of alternative, like a little punk rock.
Yeah, it's like a weird,
really cartoon, weird, yeah. Kind of, you know, in the same attitude milieu as like Ren and Stimpy, Cat Dog and all that stuff. But it was definitely, it was more innocent. So it was a little bit devoid of the meanness. It had like the kind of the earnest simplicity of conflict that a lot of like children's cartoons would have, but it was so creative in the way that it did things and the way the characters looked, the way they sound and the things that they would say. So it was slightly subversive, underground, but earnest. And I think that just kind of, they detached. It's like the idea became detached from all points of reference and context. So it became really its own kind of spaceship out in the universe. And I think that's why it stands the test of time, because it's not associated to something topical at the time. It's not associated to these memes and things like that. They just kind of did what they wanted to do based off of this world they wanted to explore and to show to the audience. So I think that's kind of what it is. It's why great art is great. It's why it's timeless, is because it really is its own thing and it doesn't rely on anything else. It's contained.
I'm looking forward to this. I'm very curious, just from the trailer alone, looks pretty absurd. And I think it's going to hit all like the check boxes that people who either have loved SpongeBob from before or people who still do it, will enjoy quite a bit. So that comes out March 4th. I'm sure you'll enjoy the screening tonight. And looking forward to hearing you as Chancellor in that. So let's jump to the movies that changed your life. So let's start off with your first pick. This is from 1975. This is Monty Python and the Holy Grail, also one of my favorite movies. Directed by the great Terry Gilliam and Terry Jones. Written and starring Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Eric Idle, Terry Gilliam, Terry Jones, and Michael Palin, also known as the iconic comedy troupe Monty Python. So talk to me about this. I mean, you are a stalwart in like comedy. I can only imagine how this movie influenced you. So what about the first time you watched Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
Man, I mean, I was a kid. I don't know how old I was. I guess it would have been, I would have been like 9 or 10 years old. And I was watching PBS on my mom's bed in her bedroom and on the little TV. And PBS was running a, you know, fundraising thing, as they do. And as a part of it, they were doing a Monty Python marathon of all their movies to date. And they announced, the Holy Grail, and I found out, it's set in medieval times. So it's going to be, I mean, that was my thing as a kid. I loved knights and medieval stuff, right. You know, fantasy books and all that stuff. And so, so I was so excited. And then, like, you know, the first scene is a beautiful green hillside with like the blue sky behind it. And you hear this. And then you just see cresting the hill. You see like, you know, the king like coming over the hill with his crown. And you see him, he kind of looks like he's on a horse. And then when it's revealed, his whole body, he's just trotting like he's acting like he's on a horse as children do. And then then Terry Gilliam behind him, as the coconut, he's taking coconuts and like rubbing them or hitting them to make them sound like, and he's got this gigantic backpack. And, you know, it's just, from that moment, when that was revealed, that's what that was, that sound and that scene and how it wasn't what I expected. From that point on through the entire rest of the movie, I was losing my mind. I was laughing so much. I was kind of out of breath, and my mom would come in to see if I was okay. It was crazy. That movie, like, it just blew open my mind. It was so stupid and ridiculous and absurd. And so much of it just constantly the whole time, because I always loved absurdity as a kid. Like, you know, I watched the Muppet Show, and the Muppet News Flash moments were always so stupid and absurd. The whole show was absurd.
The whole show is incredible. I've been rewatching some of it on Disney Plus. And it still holds up. It's so funny.
It's so good. It's another one of those things where it always remained irreverent and sincere and lovable, you know? And so growing up seeing that, I was like, oh yeah, I love absurd. But then this movie came on, there was just like absurdity turned up to 100,000%. And I just lost my shit. I was like, what the hell's happening? And then, of course, that led to me discovering the whole world of Monty Python. And, but I mean, it just taught me so well. It kind of unlearned a lot, you know. It's really kind of what that type of movie does. It completely defrags and deconstructs your notion of what is funny and what can adults do, you know, right. like are adults adults? What are humans? You know, that kind of shit.
The thing that's also great about all Python, but Monty, about Holy Grail in particular, is that movie continues to give as you get older with the movie. Like, one of my favorite scenes from the film is like, you know, I'm being oppressed. And he's just talking about like the bureaucratic nature and the hierarchy system and how like they're just serfs. And obviously I don't get that when I'm 10 years old watching it for the first time. But when you rewatch it, when they're like, I'm in college, I'm like, oh my God, like this is just so, so funny. And it just keeps delivering. I mean, did you have moments like that where like, as you rewatch it, some similar experiences?
I think this is going to sound crazy, but I think I've only seen it maybe twice. I saw it
really?
Once.
Go on about that. Yes, I'd love to hear more then.
I saw it when I was a kid, and I loved it. I mean, I loved, you know, every single scene. There wasn't really a scene where I was like, what? It was like, because even if I didn't understand, you know, they're speaking about, you know, quasi-politically, you know, when they're like, you know, they're just sitting in mud and you don't even know what they're doing. They're just like taking mud and like just moving it from one location to another. It's like the absurdity of like, what do people do and why are they even fucking working in the first place? You know, like that whole thing. But, you know, even though I may not have understood the intricacies, I knew that they were talking about like how stupid it is that we're doing whatever we're doing for whatever reason we're doing. And that was enough, you know, even the argument of the, you know, of the African swallow.
The wing flight velocity and wing speed velocity.
You know, listening to them argue or, you know, discuss the nature of physics versus the species of different types of birds. That was something that I understood to be, it's just people speaking about stuff to just kind of fill the air with things and just to have a semblance of a conversation, you know? And it was just so ridiculous that people would take that so seriously, obviously, and in their situation being in medieval times or whatever, and they're arguing over a castle wall, you know, and the guys at the bottom, the guys at the top, whatever. You know, and then the rest of the movie just kind of zooms in and out between absurdity and the, you know, existential questions of you know, human nature and things like that. And the combination of all those things, it just was so mind blowing that, you know, people, smart people with very, very silly temperaments and a will to create things that reflect that, it's rare. You know, and Monty Python just wholeheartedly, single-handedly, I mean, not all of their stuff is like brilliant, but I'd say in totality, they're one of the most important forces in, you know, it projected art in recent times, in the last 100 years.
Yeah, I mean, they're just range of stuff. Like, obviously, flying circus gags. Like some of them are more obvious, right? Like the spam skit or whatever. But then you have like Philosopher's Soccer, which I think is like the most brilliant sketch. It gets so stupid. Every line is just about everyone's different philosophies and stuff. I mean, it's
Nietzsche.
Just insane.
Yeah, and it's like, that's so good. Freud. And they did such a great, it's just great. It's like what they, it's all about extreme juxtaposition, you know, and they were so great at like taking something mundane and then just putting something extraordinary, like the funniest joke, you know, that one that was like so funny that the Germans.
Oh, right. You couldn't say it.
Yeah, you couldn't say it. And the way that the dude reacts, the German dude reacts when he finally like he reads it and he just has this like really gentle like, and just dies. And then they're all running in a battlefield with the, with the joke, and they're just
and they have their headphones
they have headphones on, so they can't hear it. Because apparently so reading good. It is okay, but you can't hear it.
It's so good. I mean, you've only watched it twice, so what was that? What about the second time you watched it? Was there a reason you decided to like throw it on again, or you just sort of?
You know, I was in my 20s. And I was young and saw the world as a different place. I just kind of wanted to see it again. I think it was with some friends, you know, in my friend group in my 20s. And we just kind of threw it on to watch it one night. And I mean, it was still kind of the same feeling. I mean, obviously as a kid, when you have that first experience.
Last question here on Holy Grail.
Yeah.
Do you like find yourself seeing like Monty Python styles of comedy like still coming into your music, your comedy, all that sort of stuff?
I mean, they inspired me to really, you know, pursue comedy, even as, you know, I was always a class clown since I can remember. I loved it. But when Monty Python came along, you know, it's like, you know, as a kid, you're always like, you get something happens and then you start mimicking it because it's so impactful to your life. And Monty Python was, I was already watching a lot of PBS. I grew up on PBS, so I watched a lot of period pieces and mystery things, you know, Mrs. Marple's and, you know, Inspector Poirot and, you know, Mystery Theater and all that stuff.
Right.
Masterpiece Theater. So I was always speaking in an English accent anyways, because I was an Anglophile. For some reason, my mother's French, but I was an Anglophile. I have no idea. I'll have to figure that out. But so I was already fascinated with that culture. And then when, you know, in the medieval stuff, I was super into it. So when that movie came out, the temperament of all those people talking like this, oh, that's nice, oh yeah, no, yeah, I would love to do that, like I totally freaked out on that. I just kind of fixated on that and would try to do as many of those accents as possible in my daily life. And so it and the absurdity of it. And just how silly. It's like, no, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. Now you are. Like, ah, yes, maybe perhaps I'm not. Like that whole logic, the double speak and the paradoxical language, I totally took that and really ran with it at school and probably annoyed many, many people.
Well, that annoyance paid off, so.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Awesome. So that was Monty Python on the Holy Grail. Let's go to your second movie. This is 1982's Pink Floyd, The Wall, directed by Alan Parker with animation by Gerald Scarfe, written by Roger Waters, with featuring the music of Roger Waters and Pink Floyd, starring Bob Geldof, Christine Hargraves, and James Lorenzen. So for those who haven't seen this one, Pink Floyd, The Wall is basically the album The Wall put to the storyline of a young rock star who is having issues with his fame, and it kind of goes backwards and forwards in time, trying to examine how he got to his point in fame, like with relationship with his mother and father, all told through the music of Pink Floyd's The Wall. So talk to me about this one.
Yeah, I saw this in 2026, and it was a different time back then. No, I probably saw this in like 1988 is when I saw it. And I was with a bunch of my friends in Helena, Montana. I grew up in Great Falls. So we're in Helena. Helena's like an hour and a half away from Great Falls in the capital. And so we were there with a bunch of actors, and cause we were there for a weekend to just kind of party with some other actors who were in competitive dramatics. And I was also a competitive drama person. So, we'd made friends while doing meets around or whatever. So we were hanging out, and we were in the basement of one of the actors. And, I think it was just like maybe like four girls and maybe three guys or something like that. We were all huddled in this basement on this couch. It was so heavy. You know, and
yeah,
it was all the things, right? It's like, again, I was an Anglophile. So it had, you know, the English, you know, heavy English classism aspects, you know, dealing with depression and psychological issues, you know, a bunch of social commentary, the unfairness of the hierarchical system. Children wanting to find originality, but being forced into this kind of like cookie cutter factory like existence. And yet it had such an amorphous, fluid journey kind of gait and tempo to it with, you know, and the music, of course. I mean, that was the central aspect of it. But the way that it just morphed from one thing to the next, it just really blew my mind. I just couldn't believe what I was watching. It was another one of those, when we were kids and we should have just been like, oh, look at that funny thing. Oh, that's weird. Why is he looking at, you know, whatever. Right. And people really didn't talk. People were just, we went into the movie. We were in the movie together. And it just blew me away because the music was so incredible and also so sad, you know, emotional, but triumphant in a way and empowering in a way and made you feel whatever they wanted us to feel. They were making us feel that way. Like it was such a clear vision. What, you know, everybody involved, the animators, the band, the vision behind it, it all unified to create this really a perfect art piece, musical art piece. And it really blew me away in the sense that, music paired with, I'd never seen a music based movie, like a movie. And obviously there was Tommy, like, you know, Pinball Wizard, all that.
Right.
But I wasn't really interested in that. And when Pink Floyd came along, it was just like, kind of like, oh yeah, sure, throw it on. And then holy shit. So that turned me on to that whole idea. I mean, aside from The Wiz, which doesn't really count.
Doesn't count, right?
But so that was my first exposure to like how powerful music when paired with visualization and storytelling in a film format, how powerful that could be.
Which, tying back to what I said at the top of the episode, I mean, when you, for folks who haven't seen Reggie perform live, I mean, you have your loop pedal in front of you, you're telling jokes in between, you're looping and you're stopping it. So, and then in a concert setting, like at a festival setting, there's lights and all this sort of stuff that really like all pair together for one storytelling, you know, comedy music experience. So that, I mean, it's interesting that that sort of stemmed from there. Is that where you kind of got the idea to merge these ideas for your own like personal performance style?
That's hard to say. I mean, since I was a little kid, I was always mixing up media anyways, you know? So if I was on the playground, you know, I used to play this game where I had my winter jacket and they had like the little tassels with like the fake horns or those like wooden nubs or whatever that fit in the loop or whatever.
Yeah,
it's like loop. It's kind of like an old world style of fastening something, which is kind of like, it's okay, but most people never use them. So they're always just dangling. And it just looks like an afterthought. But anyways, I used to stand there, you know, on the playground in winter in my coat, and I would stand motionless like a statue. And then kids would come up and they would pull on one of those things. And then I would come to life, like, you know, like those statues, you know, that you see people, whatever, like way before I even knew about the statues, I was way ahead of the curve. But I was standing on the, you know, and someone would pull the tassel thing, and then I would be like, hey, 98.9 FM, giving you the best in rock and roll. Here's a new hit from Pat Benatar. Get ready. And I would start singing it. And then every time they'd pull it, I'd change the radio station and change a song. And so I was always like just, you know, kind of ADD, you know, just switching, hard switches and things like that. And Monty Python definitely affirmed that, you know, because their whole thing was like, sometimes it would be a gradual crossfade. It was all about transitions. You know, they were masters of transitions. It'd be a gradual fade, or the camera would just pan and then there would be another set up, you know, or someone gets up and
walks into
another set, you know, or it's just be a hard cut to a new thing. So, and now for something completely different, you know, whatever. And then like this interstitial and then like a hard cut. So my mind was kind of already there. And then when I did competitive drama in high school, you know, I improvised. The first year I competed in solo, humorous solo. Second year was humorous duo. But the first year, I was just, my teacher just let me do whatever. So I was improvising and just doing like Michael Jackson impressions, Bill Cosby impressions, you know, singing a song, then like doing like a British, you know, kind of Monty Python-esque like exchange or whatever. And or physical bits, you know, like pulling fake underwear that I had and tucked in my pants, you know, like just like feeling like making it look like I ripped them out, you know, whatever, and threw them at, you know, people in the classroom. So I was always mixing all that stuff anyways. Mm-hmm. But definitely the wall, I think more in an artistic sense, if I were, it was more inspirational to me to make something like that at some point in the future.
Mm. Awesome. So let's jump to your last movie here. This is another heady movie. 1999's The Matrix, written and directed by Lana and Lily Wachowski, starring Keanu Reeves, Lawrence Fishburne, and Carrie Ann Moss. So talk to me about The Matrix.
The Matrix did this, I think it was one of the first films that didn't really advertise too much.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, they just had like the posters. I kind of remember just like posters. Really just like, and like the green text ads and stuff like that. Yeah. You didn't really know much. Right.
Yeah. And then you did see like the famous bullet time shot.
Bullet time stuff. Right.
Just like that one shot was like, people were like, what the fuck is this? You know? and I was definitely one of those people, but when I think it came out the first week it came out, I think I saw probably one of the first matinees, you know, I think matinees, technically sometimes they come out on Wednesdays or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I went to a theater. I was living in Seattle at the time. And so
oh, nice. I'm in Seattle.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Go see town.
Yeah.
It's a very different place. but I love it. The summers are great.
Yes.
Yeah. So I was in Seattle and I think I was at what's that place called?
Pacific Plaza.
Yeah, Pacific Plaza. There's a movie theater in there, I believe.
Yeah, there is.
It was, you know, probably like 2 in the afternoon, 2:30 showing or something like that. And I went in and there was probably like, I don't know, 12 people in the theater, maybe. And I was with my friend Sean and maybe another friend. And we sat down. The movie came on and, you know, the beginning is like, so empowering, like that whole like what's going on. There's like a voice that comes on and it's like guiding him and he's like what the f- is going on, and then like he's getting these clues and insights, you know, and the guy, like, you know, his neighbor wants him to do a thing and he gives him a disc or whatever, and he's like, it's like, have you ever thought that maybe we're in a dream, or, you know, whatever he says, and then the guy's like, oh yeah, it's called, as you say, mescaline, mescaline or peyote. He's like, yeah, it's called mescaline. Yeah. It's the only way to fly. And I was like, oh, that's so controversial. And then the moment where, you know, the moment where Carrie Ann Moss is like, you know, she's running from the agents or whatever, and she's in the phone booth and there's like the truck, you know, heading for her. And she's like, she looks and she puts her hand on the door and then, you know, it's over. And then the phone's just like hanging there and like, what is going on? That whole notion of being in another reality, you know, coming from another reality, but being present in an alternate reality that isn't the base reality. I mean, just blew my mind. And the whole idea of it being computer-based and science-based mm-hmm. and technical, mixed with the sexiness. It's like, you know, because sometimes a movie is like, you know, here's a world, here's how characters dress and act, and here's the language they use, and this is the way it looks visually. And you're like, oh, it's sometimes just cool looking, right? But having it be a virtual world, there's a reason for it to look cool. There's mm-hmm. a reason why they're driving in a Continental with suicide doors. There's a reason why, you know, she's always wearing these sick suits or whatever. There's a reason why, you know. And so it gave it this cool context where you're like, on the outside, people are just kind of like, poor and wearing ratty clothing and eating amino acid, you know, whatever slop.
Right.
But when they're inside, they really style it up. but that whole idea mixed with a messianic kind of tale. I mean, it was so many things happening simultaneously, and it just hit every cool factor. I mean, it was the big beat music, electronic music, sexy, like BDSM, gender roles, you know,
non-conforming gender roles, even.
Yes, you know, non-conforming gender roles. Yeah, I guess that's what I mean. Yeah, it's a non-conforming gender roles, club culture, underground culture, and mixed with, you know, the danger of a system that's self-created ultimately by us, by humanity itself, that's then, you know, cognizant and then running its own paradigm, its own program. I mean, all that shit was dope. And then the idea that you could bend, if you became aware of your reality, you could actually bend reality. You could bend the rules of the reality. And then of course it was heavy, man. It was a heavy movie and it hit me. And I went and saw that movie probably 7 times in the theater. And I was taking different friends to see it.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I rewatched this maybe a year or two ago, and I remember, and I watched with my wife, she had never seen it. And I remember when she watched it, she was like kind of in awe of how predictive the movie was. I mean, sci-fi always kind of tends to end up being predictive in various ways, but The Matrix, like in a lot of ways, like really, really is obviously like the extreme stuff, but just like the VR-ness and how people are scared that the machines are going to take over and all this sort of stuff. I mean, they just hit everything on the head, basically. I think it's also, speaking of timeless things, why it also makes it like a timeless movie is that you can see where they're coming from, but just years ahead of everyone else.
Yeah. I mean, it is, and in my mind, yes, it definitely has the timeless factor because it was speaking on things that were kind of inevitable. I mean, if you're in tune with technology, it wasn't that, you know, they were just in tune with it. So you could just see where the net was heading anyways. Obviously they're extrapolating like far in the future, but, you know, it's kind of like a warning thing, but obviously it's just like a world of like consideration, but it's almost a perfect movie, I would say, except for,
yes,
the very, very end when he's in the telephone booth and he gets done and then he flies away. If I could have a re-edit of that movie, I would have him not fly away. I would have him.
And it even freeze frames, right? Doesn't it freeze frame on him flying?
I think so.
Even add, make it a little bit goofier.
Yeah. And I was like, that thing. Like that was the only part that it just took me out. I was like, why? Like, why, you know, what? He's like, he can master reality. Like, why, you know, fly away at the end? It was just kind of, it was weird. So, but other than that, and maybe the flex was a little, it was an interesting moment. I was like,
and the waves, the
vroom, yeah. Vroom. And I was like, that's interesting. I was kind of like on the fence about that one, but everything else, I mean, like I know Kung Fu, you know, I mean, all that shit, it was,
I love that.
Even the thing, like, where it's like, we're just batteries, you know, like that, that idea. I love how like, that's just stupid, right? Like they're like, why would machines would just invent battery tech? Why would they need humans to, you know, create an artificial reality so they didn't know that they were being harnessed for energy? I mean, even that, it was fine because it's just, I love how simple that was. Like, yeah, this one, this need us for power, which I just think that's great. And also that whole the construct scene, you know, the training sequences that whole thing about, you know, agents being able to inhabit any body that they want at any given point. And like, you know, him, you know, look again or whatever. And the woman in the red dress who's distracting him is an agent with like a oversized 45 around, Magnum, you know?
when he goes, you like the girl in red? Hey, I made her. I can set up a date, right?
Oh yeah, that's right. I know. That's so nerdy. I mean, that's obviously such a like a coder bullshit
I know.
That they would totally do. It's like, oh, you really like him? You like it? Like, oh, yeah.
Has a Matrix influenced you, like your work in any way, do you find, or sort of just was sort of a awakening for you as a viewer?
Definitely put me on that quest of, you know, the kind of simulation theory of life. I was already feeling that way as a kid anyways, you know, because the idea of virtual reality did exist in the 80s as well, obviously. And then before that, it was just like dreams or like Carlos Castaneda, like how to become aware of yourself in dreams, you know. So that idea of becoming aware of awareness itself and then that cascading effect of awareness on top of itself, awareness is something I was interested in as a kid. But then, you know, there was like Virtual Boy and, you know, and early virtual reality, like 1987, like it's like virtual reality promises to blow, you know, like there's like this, the future is virtual reality, of course, you know, so I was a little bit of aware of it. And then of course, like 13th Floor came out, which was another like amazing movie, Existenz.
Right.
And, you know, The Matrix, and there were these like alternate reality movies or even like, I'll take it back to 1983 maybe, Dreamscape.
Dreamscape, yeah.
That was, you know, that was a show about, you know, people who had the ability to be active inside of other people's dreams, inside the dreamscape. And so the guy is like hired to be an assassin to like kill the president in his dreams. But but a fantastic, amazing movie. And I saw it with my dad, actually. I'm just remembering this for the first time. But, you know, so that idea of like going into other realities or even Narnia, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia,
right.
that type of stuff.
Sure.
So that was there. But The Matrix kind of quantified it in such a sexy way that incorporated my love of electronic music and subculture and all that stuff. So it definitely has it had a huge impact in that I kind of went deeper into those thought processes and, you know, and even, you know, inspiring me to, you know, research more of the quantum physicists, you know, at the time releasing their books about like the possibilities of reality and like the Tao of physics and those types of books that were like comparing Eastern mysticism with modern theoretical quantum physics. So it definitely, it's just always in there, you know, that idea of programming language, using that to describe our current world and viewing our world as like a computer simulation to an extent, I find to be kind of healthy.
All right. So last question here. We have Monty Python on the Holy Grail, Pink Floyd, The Wall, and The Matrix. Do you see a through line between the three films as to why you selected these films to talk about today?
Oh, nice. I think they all deal with reorienting our association to reality. And, you know, it's like you should question reality. So I hate that phrase because it just sounds like a terrible bumper sticker. But it does make you question your life and your role in it and what are human beings and why am I even aware of myself and why am I even able to ask the questions of why am I aware? You know, so... Mm. And how does it relate? How can it be related to your life and in real moments that aren't just conceptual? Like, how does it make you feel emotionally about things that have happened to you? How does it make you want to project a different reality you'd like to live in that you think would be more helpful to people? Like, I think that that's kind of the through line. It's kind of to defrag, decontextualize, make you disoriented, and then think of ways of, well, what does that mean to me? And how is that useful? Aside from, you know, as an artist, like I want to achieve that form of altered state. I want to be able to project an idea that creates an altered state for a moment for people to consider themselves in a different context. So I think all of those movies do that very, very well. And with, you know, in the case of Monty Python, the absurdity and the silliness and just how funny it is, and The Matrix serious, and you know, but there are those moments of levity that are beautiful. Mm-hmm. and then with Pink Floyd's The Wall, doesn't ever get funny, but it's but it puts you in a world, it just puts you in this world that has its own version of levity, and so yeah, I think that they're all related in that way.
All right. Well, this was a lot of fun. I loved hearing your perspective on all of these, like half what I expected to hear. And then just a bunch of stuff that I just like loved hearing you talk about like in depth. So the SpongeBob movie, On the Run, March 4th, you're playing Chancellor. Anything else about that?
Just, you know, check it out if you can.
Awesome. Well, thanks a lot. And we'll talk soon.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much. I'll see you next week. Same time.
Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to head over to imdb.com/podcasts for more content on Reggie and to easily add the movies that changed his life to your IMDb watch list.